Evening, everybody. Wonderfully behaved audience. Actually went quiet before anyone did anything, which is great. My name's Chris Stevens. I'm head of displays here at Tate Britain, and it's been my great privilege and pleasure to re-fashion the exhibition, The Vorticists, Manifesto for a Modern World, for Tate Britain, after its tour from the National Museum of Art at Duke University in North Carolina and the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice. Welcome to this conference. I'm delighted you can all be here, and I hope you'll stay for the duration through tomorrow. Tomorrow is broken into two halves, one looking at vorticism and its various relationships with American culture, and in the afternoon looking at vorticism beyond painting and sculpture, looking at the sort of literary and political dimensions of the movement. I want to first of all thank the team here at Tate Britain who've organised this conference at breakneck speed and back to back with a conference on James Stirling, which was here only 7 days ago. That's Madeline Keep, Marion Mulvey, and Joella Genscher, who have pulled it all together after I sort of bullied and insisted that we did something. I did that with the help of several other people. Andre Gasiorek, and the two exhibition curators, Vivian Green from the Guggenheim and Mark Antliff from Duke University. Before I thank them particularly for the show, I want to thank all the speakers, people who are here this evening, and the people who will speak tomorrow. It's great to have such a great lineup of contributors, and I think the program promises to be very interesting and engaging and open up new sides to our thinking about vorticism. And I think for me that's the exciting thing about this exhibition, that it, coming as it does from the United States, I think it opens up a different perspective on a British movement. Here at Tate Britain, dealing with British art, we tend to generate almost all our exhibitions and try and send them elsewhere. So it's very nice to get a view on what we tend to see as a British art movement from abroad, and the way that that view not only brings works from collections in North America, but also ideas, and I think draws out the North American contribution and aspects of the vorticist phenomenon, both the American contributors and the presence of vorticism in New York in 1917. You'll all have an opportunity to see that in the exhibition after this evening's discussion, if you haven't already. So I'm very grateful to Mark Antliff and Vivian Green for what is a fantastic exhibition. I'm sure everybody's going to agree with that. And finally, before I hand over and start the proceedings, I want to thank the Terra Foundation for American Art, who supported this event very generously. And it's a reflection, again, of the fact that this exhibition and this occasion is taking vorticism out of the somewhat parochial history of British art into something much more international, both European, continental European, and North American. There have been a number of publications on vorticism in the last 10, 20 years, and one or two small exhibitions here in Britain and in Europe. This show was the first in North America, extraordinarily, and the first in Italy. What's pleasing is to get this new perspective for a London audience, I think. We were very conscious at the Tate that approaching vorticism through an exhibition in a major venue, one is inevitably in the shadow of the great definitive show at the Hayward Gallery in 1974, Vorticism and Its Allies, which really recuperated the movement so successfully that it has remained in people's minds ever since. That thought stimulated the idea for this evening's discussion, which is to reflect on the differences between the current exhibition and that landmark show 37 years ago, and the what has happened in between. So to think informally and to invite everyone to take part in a discussion about what has changed in our thinking and understanding about vorticism in the last three or more decades. So I'm really delighted to have not only the curators of the current show, but the curator of the 1974 show, Richard Cork, who must have been doing it in the school holidays. And Paul Edwards, who has, as everyone will know, has made an extraordinary contribution to our knowledge of vorticism, and in particular of Wyndham Lewis's life and work. They're going to be introduced and managed by Tom Normand, who's senior lecturer in the history of art at St Andrews University. Tom has published on Wyndham Lewis, as well as on various aspects of modern and postmodern Scottish art and photography. We're particularly appreciative that Tom is here, as he became a grandfather for the first time earlier this week. So on that happy note, I'm going to hand over to the panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Actually, yes, I did become a grandfather. My wife's in the audience, and you've no idea what I had to do to stop her bringing the photographs and showing each one of you every photograph. I'd like to welcome you here. This is a very special kind of pleasure for me. It's some time ago that I wrote on Wyndham Lewis and vorticism, but I am interested in this area of modernism, and I've done quite a lot in respect of Scottish modernism. My job here is to introduce those who will introduce you to aspects of the history, the literature, the exhibitions that constitute our understanding of vorticism. I'm, of course, going to introduce you to Richard Cork, Paul Edwards, Vivian Green, and Mark Antliffe in that order. And I'll give a fuller introduction at the time. But I think the position here is that I'll introduce the speakers. They'll give us a talk on their various kind of themes and topics that I'll let you know what they are. And then I'll probably offer a few questions up, but then I'd very much like to offer you the opportunity to provide questions for the panel here. And I get the feeling that there will be a lot of things that you will want to say. So I'd like to begin by introducing Richard Cork. I think overall we should see this as this event here as a kind of prelude to the conference that will come tomorrow. And that conference will mark the exhibition of Vorticist works that we see here at the Tate. But any number of years ago, Richard Cork discovered this movement. I hesitate even to say rediscovered it, because there is a sense in which it had almost completely vanished from the annals of art history. There was a great deal of talk, or at least a few literary works on Wyndham Lewis, but very little discussion of vorticism. And in 1974, when Richard Cork put that exhibition on at the Hayward Gallery, it was genuinely, I think, an eye-opener. But to accompany that, he published two volumes of books on vorticism. And I recall when I started my PhD, which was going to be on vorticism, the avant-garde, I went up to the library to pick these two books out, and more or less slipped my desk trying to get them down to my office. They are mammoth. They are comprehensive. And they are still, I think, a landmark publication in our understanding of vorticism. So I'd like to invite Richard to speak, if you like, about that discovery of the vorticist movement back in 1974 and its projection on, at least onto the British stage, if not quite onto the world stage at that point in time. Richard Cork.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Just now, Chris said that I did it in my school days. Wasn't quite that, but I have to take you back to the late 1960s. Does anybody remember them? Yeah. When I was at Cambridge and struggling to study art history, it wasn't very easy because first thing they told me was that you can't do art history for part one in Cambridge. You can only do it for part two. So I had to do 2 years English, and all that time I was obsessed by art, totally obsessed, not only writing about art, but also painting and drawing. I just could not ever stop. And I mention that because that bears very directly on why I decided to write about vorticism for my dissertation. We all had to write a dissertation for our finals, and I thought I'd love to do something on somebody who was both a writer and a painter. And I'd just come across Wyndham Lewis. I'd just come across the fact that he was not only a remarkable painter, but also an equally remarkable writer, not just novels, but criticism and autobiography and all kinds of things. And so I thought, OK, Wyndham Lewis. So I went to the university library, which in those days, don't know whether it is now, I can't imagine, but you used to be able to float in and say, good morning, I'm from Trinity Hall and I'd like everything you've got on Wyndham Lewis. And they'd say, do sit down, we will bring it to you. What? So I sat down and this guy, within minutes it seems, arrived with a trolley absolutely stacked with all the stuff they had on Wyndham Lewis. I could not believe my eyes. That guy was prolific. And I started sorting through it, thinking, this is overwhelming, I can't cope, I'm only a student, I can't do this for a dissertation, this is too much. And as I was thinking that, I saw the word blast coming out of the pile of books. I thought, what's that? Because I'd never heard of it. I mean, there was nothing to read about vorticism, there was no book or anything. I mean, I just thought, blast? And I picked it out, started going through the pages. Blast first, from politeness, England. Curse its climate. That's quite good, actually, isn't it? Curse its climate for its sins and infections. Victorian vampire, the London cloud sucks the town's heart. It's as true now as it was in 1914. And I just became dizzy with excitement reading this incredible manifesto, blasting, blessing, and then going on to the essays, and then looking at all these illustrations, not only in Blast number one with the pink cover and the great jagged thing going across the side, but also, of course, Blast number two, the war number. Illustrations by artists whose names I had never come across. I thought, what is all this? It happened in London in 1914. This is incredibly interesting, and I've got to find out more. Because, of course, it was a crazy thing to take on as a dissertation. It was just a huge, huge, overwhelming subject. But I was very lucky. I shot off to London and I met Anthony Doffe, who was a young dealer. He was about to organise a show in 1969 called something like English Art of that period. And he was collecting pictures, sculptures of that period, and he was able to show them to me. Provide me with photographs for my dissertation, which was invaluable. And I also met people in London who had memories. Above all, wonderful lady Lillian Bomberg, David's widow, in her flat in Hampstead. I could not believe my eyes. She sat there surrounded by what looked like a retrospective of David's work because, I mean, he was a failure as an artist. He'd never hardly sold anything, particularly in his later career. She had virtually everything. And it was extraordinary to sit down with Lillian and to share her memories. So I wrote the dissertation, and then I was mad enough to suggest to the Arts Council, who in those days ran the Hayward Gallery, that the Vorticist exhibition might be a good idea. And I remember in particular not only Joanna Drew, who more or less ran the Hayward Gallery, but also Norbert Linton was very much behind the idea. I was only 24 or something when I suggested it to them, so it was a very sort of weird thing to take on. But it was incredibly exciting. To do it at the Hayward was exciting too, because this was a new gallery. It had only been open a few years. And particularly interesting was this mad idea of reconstructing rock drill. Because the more I looked at the photographs of it, the more I read about this first version of rock drill, which no longer existed, I thought, wouldn't it be fabulous to reconstruct it? Again, I was incredibly lucky. I mean, I was so lucky on so many fronts, I can't tell you. I went to the Rocky Horror Show. You won't believe this. I went to the Rocky Horror Show. And afterwards, I met Ken Cook and Anne Christopher, and I happened to say to them, what I really want to do is reconstruct rock drill. They said, oh, yeah, rock drill, yeah, we can do it. And they were like my age. But they were absolutely so professional and so certain, and they knew all about it. And we all shot off down to Cornwall because the Science Museum told me that there was a rock drill museum down at this place called Camborne in Cornwall. Shot down there, and there was a rock drill museum, can you imagine, full of rock drills. And there was one that was pretty much, damn it, as near as possible to what we could see in the photographs of Epstein's sculpture. And they were so kind, they said, yes, of course you can borrow it. And then later on they said, yes, of course you can keep it forever, you can have it. And Ken and Anne were just so brilliant. Don't know whether they're here tonight, but they were so brilliant. And they did this fabulous reconstruction. And that's one of the excitements of doing an exhibition, actually, to have the opportunity to do something like that. And my first child was born just before the exhibition opened, Adam. So it was a very memorable year, 1974. And, of course, it helped me enormously, looking at the work that was assembled in that show, to finish writing my book, which I was also struggling to do. And, I mean, really, looking back now, yes, it was very weird that vorticism was forgotten for so long. But on the other hand, an awful lot of the work had been lost. It was only in the mid-1960s, would you believe, that early work by David Bomberg, for example, came to light. It had been, for the last half a century, Lillian told me, in storage. He'd put it in storage before he went off to the First World War. Can you imagine all those paintings, the mud bath, In the Hold, Vision of Ezekiel, Jiu-Jitsu, all the drawings, all the watercolours, in a store where they remained for 50 years. It's hard to believe, but it's true. And only after David's death in the late 1950s did Lillian think, hang on a minute, the storeroom, she'd never been there. She was his wife. She'd never been there. And she went there with Denora, her daughter, and they could not believe their eyes. And some of it was put on show in London in the mid-1960s. It was a revelation. And the Tate, thank goodness, just went in there and bought most of the key examples. So that was just great. But that's an instance of what had happened to an awful lot of the vorticist work. It had been just either lost or tucked away somewhere. And it's been coming out of hiding ever since. I probably vastly overrun my time.
You have, Richard, yes. It's been very much worth it. I always enjoy listening to Richard. I'm slightly worried this is getting very family-orientated with grandsons and sons. One of the joys of comparing this event is that I get to ask questions immediately afterwards. I will come to you, I promise. But I was quite interested when Richard said that the impetus, the initial shock for him, was to see Wyndham Lewis's work. And I know, of course, that Wyndham Lewis can fascinate and can seduce. And one of the interesting things about Richard's books, I think, is that they actually range quite widely across vorticists, so that Lewis isn't given that position he demanded in 1956 when he had an exhibition in the Tate Gallery, when he claimed, of course, that vorticism was what he did and said. But with Richard, we have all sorts of figures who are given almost an equal weight. Epstein, of course, and Gaudier, but also figures like Arbuthnot and others. And I just wondered how did you come round to that notion that Lewis was not the central figure here, given the catalogue of 1956, when he says this is all about me.
Exactly. Well, that show at the Tate in 56 just stirred up so much antagonism from the other vorticist artists, most notably William Roberts, who started issuing an extraordinary series of pamphlets. If you've never come across them, I do recommend, because that guy, William Roberts, could write. And he had anger. And he wasn't the only one, because he got hold of David Bomberg, who was shut away in Ronda in Spain, and said, Bomberg! They didn't call each other by their Christian names. It was all surname stuff. Bomberg, do you know what's happening here in London? It's a scandal. And Bomberg was sent a copy of the catalogue, went to the back and realised that he'd been given something like one drawing or one watercolour. And he was depressed anyway because he was in a very, very tough state. And it just plummeted him downwards, and he started writing obsessively, page after page after page, trying to sort of come to terms with what he saw as the ultimate humiliation. William Roberts felt so humiliated that not only did he produce all these pamphlets, but he also started claiming that he wasn't a vorticist at all. It all got very confusing because at the same time he was painting that enormous picture, which starts off the show here at the Tate, of the vorticists at the Tour Eiffel restaurant, and he's in the painting. So he had a sort of strange kind of confused attitude. And the other thing was, Tom, can you imagine, there's me, very, very young and eager, coming to London, realising that William Roberts was virtually the only surviving member of the vorticist movement. He lived in Primrose Hill. He refused to see not only me, but everybody else in the entire world. He was a total recluse. His wife, who was chatterbox, a wonderful chatterbox, she said, oh, no, William never sees anybody. He hardly ever talks. He won't allow me or our son John into his studio. And so it was incredibly frustrating because I was dying to go and see him and to ask him 100 questions and he would not see anybody. So it was all quite surreal, really.
I often feel that artists do their reputation no good by not opening up these kinds of negotiations. And Roberts was one of those poor souls. But I, one of the things I wondered was, and forgive me for continuing here, but one of the things I was interested in your book is, clearly Lewis has an idea of what a vorticist aesthetic is, and it relates to that thing that you subtitle your book. It's an art of the machine and the machine age. Mm. But forgive me for this, Mark, someone like Gaudí seems to me to be a very organic sculptor, very interested in nature, very interested in soft forms, intrigued by even something like bird swallowing fish, which you speak a great deal of in your book, seems to me still to be an image about, fundamentally about nature rather than about the machine. And I wonder if you found yourself content to develop these figures all as vortices, as if singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were.
Yes, I was, because, of course, there's a manifesto page in Glass which contains the names of these artists, and not only artists, but also photographers. They're there in a vertical list. They do not include, it's very interesting to note, they do not include Epstein or Bomberg, neither of whom agreed to have their names added to the manifesto. Lillian said to me, oh, well, David hated joining things. He would never join anything. She said after the First World War, David was invited to join the De Stijl movement over in Holland, and he was tempted, but he said no. He wasn't a joiner. He was a loner, classic loner, actually. Epstein, pretty much the same, but Epstein actually agreed, at least I suppose, to have his work reproduced in Blast, which Bomberg didn't. So that's interesting, isn't it? Very interesting. But there are all sorts of people in that list, and Gaudier is amongst them, very much. Mm. And Gaudier was very close to Ezra Pound, who was deeply involved in the genesis of vorticism. Gaudier knew Lewis very well. And I think, actually, I'd probably disagree with you, Tom, I think Bird Swallowing Fish is a very mechanistic sculpture, actually.
Maybe Mark will have thought on that later, I'm sure. Later, Mark, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you. You'll all be able to ask questions of Richard later on. I'd like to introduce Paul Edwards. And Paul's going to speak to the literature on vorticism and on Wyndham Lewis. Partly on Wyndham Lewis because Paul has written what is undoubtedly the best and certainly the most comprehensive book on Lewis. It was published in 2000 by Yale, Wyndham Lewis, Painter and Writer, and a very fine work. He's also, more recently, curator of both the portrait exhibition that was in the National Portrait Gallery of Lewis's portraits, of course after vorticism, but an astonishing exhibition, I thought, and it was so great to see all those portraits together. and of course of a recent exhibition on Wyndham Lewis's art in Madrid, which I'm afraid I didn't get over to see. But Paul, you're going to talk to us about the literature of Waterism. Yeah?
Yes, I'm sort of trying to, you know, we've already heard that Vorticism is a movement with very permeable boundaries. I mean, that's the case in terms of time and in terms of personnel and who wanted to be in it and what kind of work should be considered Vorticist. Because it's so permeable, I think it's shaped in our minds by the approach that historians and critics have taken towards it. So what I just want to do is outline about five traditions. Sorry, I could have had more, I could have had less, but I chose five. Seven, the mystic number might have been best, but anyway. Vorticist historiography since, more or less, the early 70s. And of course, these traditions aren't as distinct as I make them, but I hope they'll be a useful way of mapping some approaches that have emerged over the years. And most of these approaches, I think, remain open and waiting to be developed, and will be developed, I think, in this symposium. Now, only one tradition, I think, which I'm not really going to talk about because it's the most basic of all, that all the others depend on, only one has reached a pretty definitive form, and thanks actually to Richard's research. And that tradition is, what exactly happened when, who did what, and what works remain. And it's thanks to Richard that so much of that history has been recovered instead of dying with the last participants 40 or 50 years ago. There we are. So here's the first tradition. Vorticism as a literary aesthetic, or primarily a literary aesthetic, and a literary aesthetic developed mainly by Ezra Pound, an aesthetic that enabled him to move beyond static imagism to the larger dynamic structures of the cantos, as he traced the patterned energies of nature and cultures across time. And the main proponent and pioneer of this tradition is Hugh Kenner in his 1972 book, The Pound Era. And there have been offshoots to this, so it does form an actual tradition. Timothy Matra's Vortex, Pound, Eliot and Lewis in 1979. Reed Way Dazenbrock's Literary Vorticism of Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis from 1985. And Vorticism, including Lewis's writing, is seen here as essential in the history of modernist literature in English. And I suppose one might say, I don't know if Rebecca would agree, but Rebecca Beasley's work contributes, not exclusively by any means, to this tradition as well. So that's the first tradition. The second is Vorticism is what I did and said at a certain period. What Wyndham Lewis said and did and said, in other words, that famous statement from the Tate retrospective of Lewis, at which he was a bit irritated to have to share the space with other painters. Fair enough, since it was his retrospective. Anyway. In order to understand Vorticism, you need to understand the development of Wyndham Lewis's work. That's the underlying assumption of this approach. Lewis as a painter, a public intellectual, an aesthetic theorist and novelist, by far and away the most towering figure of the Vorticists. And this tradition takes Lewis at his word when he writes that fateful sentence. And I suppose my own work on Lewis, because it's on Lewis, treats vorticism in this way, and also the work of Alan Munton as well looks at vorticism in this way. We now come to the third way, which is vorticism in the history of British and English art in particular. And to some extent, Richard's work contributes to this, and there are also larger histories of English art, such as Charles Harrison's English Art and Modernism from 1983, or David Peters Corbett's The Modernity of English Art. And then think also of the big Royal Academy exhibition in 1987, British Art in the 20th Century, the Modern Movement. And I suppose that specialist studies of individual artists, such as Evelyn Silver's and Richard's recent exhibition, Wild Thing, also contribute to this tradition. The fourth tradition, which I think is not altogether separate from the previous one these days, which is vorticism as discussing it in terms of social and political history as a phenomenon of its historical moment, but also as a vehicle for the expression of certain political ideas. And what that historical moment was is characterised in various ways, depending on the focus of the writer's inquiry, of course. This was initiated, I think, by the other great pioneer of study of vorticism, William Weiss, in his book Vorticism and the English Avant-Garde from 1972. And that book is an aesthetic equivalent of George Dangerfield's The Strange Death of Liberal England, and he's seeing vorticism as a sort of expression of the same historic process. More recently, there's been Paul Pepys, Literature, Politics, and the English Avant-Garde, Nation and Empire, 1901 to 1918, which was published in 1997. And to some extent, Tom's own book on Lewis's art, Holding the Mirror Up to Politics, falls into this category as well. I don't know whether André Gassiorek's work on Lewis and Hume should also be considered part of this strand. These are very indefinite strands, anyway. What I do think, though, is that feminist studies can be, and this, I don't know if any of you recognize that small figure dwarfed by those policemen. It's Dora Marsden, the editor of The New Free Woman that became The Egoist, suffragette, later follower of Stirner. This whole moment has been seen in as part of feminist history as well. And the studies by Jane Beckett and Deborah Cherry in the Ashgate collection I edited last Vorticism, then I think expanded and included in a collection by Katie Deepwell as well. There's Lisa Tickner's amazing study of gender in Lewis's vorticist and pre-vorticist work, and more recently Miranda Hickman's The Geometry of Modernism in 2006. And accompanying this, there's been a more serious appraisal of Helen Saunders, for example, with an exhibition at the Ashmolean organised by Biddy Pepin in 1996. And there is another one, also organised by Biddy, shortly to open down in Castle Carey. The final tradition is vorticism as part of international modernism and the avant-garde. The beginning of an internationalist approach that no longer sees vorticism as merely a follower of international, mainly European modernism, but as a participant in it. It's no longer an example of English exceptionalism. And this tradition begins to see past the nationalist element of blast propaganda to its international links. Anthony Dauphée first noticed the reproduction of Lewis's portrait of an Englishwoman on the right there in the Russian periodical Strelets, The Archer, and the influence of blast and vorticism on Russian futurism and suprematism, particularly on L. Lissitzky, who you may have noticed from Craig Rain's review, didn't mention vorticism in his History of Isms. But you see by the picture on the left and his praise of blast typography that he certainly knew it. In Italy, Gianni Cianci and Tuccarini in the early 80s treated vorticism as essentially part of futurism instead of being a total rejection of it. And this was reflected in the huge futurism exhibition organised by Pontus Ultan in 1986, as well as by the more recent one at Tate Modern, which originated in Paris. And to some extent, partly by virtue of its host institution, the Esterick Collection, Jonathan Black's 2004 exhibition, Blasting the Future, Vorticism in Britain, with three essays in the catalogue on vorticism and futurism, as well as Jonathan Wood's essay on Godier, can be seen as contributing to this tradition. Paris had recognised the movement in a small scale in a display at the Pompidou, Wyndham Lewis et le Vorticisme, in 1982, and the publication of a book on Lewis, as well as more recently in 2009, a catalogue of Godier's work in the Pompidou with essays by Richard Cork and Evelyn Silber, putting Godier in the context of vorticism. International Centre for Structural Analysis of Constructivism in Belgium published a book on vorticism, edited by Andrew Wilson. And in 1996, there was the biggest vorticist exhibition since Richard's at the Haywood, and that was at Hanover and then moved to Munich, curated by Karen Orchard, and the links with expressionism particularly came out in the attendant conference. And there's now tons of interest in Lewis in Spain, thanks largely to the energetic activities of Alan Munton. And the big Lewis retrospective at the Fundación Juan Marc in Madrid last year was premised on the judgment that Lewis was an artist of international significance. And they wanted to add a small room for other vorticists. Until Dick Humphreys and I persuaded them that the precedents for this were not good. So, anyway, in various ways, the current exhibition curated by Mark and Vivian is a culmination of all these traditions, but particularly the last. It sees visual vorticism as having a presence in the US and being a tangible participant in its visual culture. This means seeing the 1917 Penguin Club exhibition of vorticism as more than a marketing exercise by Pound to get John Quinn to buy as many Wyndham Lewis as possible. Pound and Lewis definitely did want a transatlantic dimension to vorticism, and Lewis welcomed Pound's suggestion after he dispatched the exhibition to New York in April 1916 for an American number of Blast. More general reflections, quickly. Richard's exhibition and his monumental book on vorticism were intended to show, as we've heard, that vorticism wasn't just what Wyndham Lewis said and did. And it was an immense act of recovery. Nearly 450 exhibits, not all works of art, but a lot of them. It was a tremendous refutation also of Clive Bell's dismissal of the movement as a puddle of provincialism. Interestingly, that Bell's note of snobbish condescension is still around today, as and was struck again in Craig Rain's review in The Guardian. Now, I quoted Lewis on claiming credit for vorticism, but it's another Lewis statement or idea that haunted the 1974 exhibition and all subsequent accounts of vorticism, and that is, we are the first men of a future that has not materialized. Lewis was actually talking about his fellow writers from 1914, Joyce, Eliot, and Pound, but it refers also to this whole avant-garde movement. Vorticism is almost inescapably a movement whose promise went unfulfilled, snuffed out by the First World War within a few months. And what was that promise? Well, to simplify, for Anthony Dauphé and Richard in the late 60s and early 70s, it was the total emancipation of visual art from representation. As Dauphé put it in his 1969 catalogue, Abstract Art in England, 1913-15, certainly our interest in the movement today must be centred on the degree of abstraction it achieved. And for Richard, at that time, moved on obviously since then, but the war art that the vorticists abandoned their abstraction for represented a retreat to what he called a tame form of figuration which betrayed the precepts they had struggled so hard to establish in 1914. The first properly worked out critique of this formalist bias, and it's no more than a bias, for there are traces of threads of quite other interpretations in Richard's understanding, what came in a small essay by Michael Derman and Alan Munton in 1982, Wyndham Lewis and the Nature of Vorticism, in Cianci's volume on Lewis, which stressed both the content of Lewis's painting and its formal development as a critique of contemporary developments in fauvism, cubism, and futurism. And it saw vorticism's most important characteristic as an anti-Bergsonian attitude of critical contemplation in contradiction to the immersive participation demanded by futurism. And it's an interpretation of vorticism that David Peters Corbett presupposes in The Modernity of English Art, 1914-30. For him, this is the key why that future of art never materialized. Vorticism, he said, is not a genuine or pure avant-garde in that ultimately it works in an aesthetic arena that it separates from life and action. Thus, in the 1920s, with the recall to order, Lewis could no longer hold the avant-garde pass because he'd already acknowledged implicitly that a viable representation and critique of modernity could actually take place through aesthetic means that were ultimately traditional. The unfulfilled legacy of vorticism was, in a sense, Lewis's fault, and not just because of his egotism and hopeless lack of organizing skills. Finally, for me, the book that changed or enlarged vorticism most radically was Mark Antliff's Inventing Bergson, Cultural Politics and the Parisian Avant-Garde, 1992. That's an odd judgment, because there's no Lewis, there's no Pound, there's no Epstein, there's no Godier, there's no vorticism in it, though Jessica Dismore is there. But reading it, it became clear to me how completely Wyndham Lewis's intellectual and political world was imbricated with that of the Parisian avant-garde at this time. The book suggested a far more complex relationship between Lewis's work and the philosophy of Bergson, and showed exactly how important Bergsonism was as a site for disputing politics, aesthetics, and philosophy before and during the vorticist period. Lewis's thought was shaped in the Parisian world of Bergson, on the left, René Gillouin, whose book of selections from Bergson is at the bottom right. Lewis's copy is in Texas. Georges Sorel, the bottom center there. Edward Berthe at the top there, whose work Lewis discusses. The robber Garnier, the Bono gang of the top right there. Anarchism, Steinerian egoism, as well as the world of fauvism and cubism. More recently, some work, I gather, has been done on this by Charlotte DeMille as well. It seemed to me this book gave a blueprint for inserting vorticism in the history it belongs to, securely as an active participant in the pre-war international avant-garde, not a chauvinistic imitation of movements it only half understood, and not, in Clive Bell's words, a puddle of provincialism.
Very good. Thank you, Paula. Clearly, we all have to do a lot of reading. I find that fascinating, Paul, and really very helpful. It does seem to me that a lot of the strongest work, coming particularly from American universities, is on literary vorticism. Is there any reason why you think that would be the case?
I think it's probably died, it's fallen back a little bit. Mm. I think probably because of the immense sort of prestige of Hugh Kenner as the person who, you know, who sort of told everybody, explained Joyce, Pound, particularly Pound, and, you know, sort of was such a dominant figure that...
And can I be cheeky and ask you why you left Frederick Jameson out of that list? Was there any reason?
Because I was trying to talk about vorticism, and I don't think, although Fred Jameson gave an interesting talk in which he called Lewis a towering figure in that room there, he said, when we had a similar event at Duke. But he's concerned with... There are people who are concerned with Lewis who are not concerned with vorticism.
Yeah.
So, and I think that would probably include him. Mm-hmm. So it's not a sort of history of Lewis scholarship, mm-hmm. but vorticist history I'm trying to give.
Well, thanks very much. I thought that was really helpful, and I thought it was helpful in particular in setting the scene for the exhibition that I hope we're all going to go and see after the final discussion that we have here. And this comes from, I think it's a joint presentation by Mark Atcliffe and Vivian Green. And together, of course, they curated this exhibition. Vivian Green is known principally, in fact, as a curator of some of the most excellent shows working for the Guggenheim of European modernism. And she's currently, I think, working on a major exhibition on futurism that we'll all be interested in. Mark Antliff's work you've already been introduced to. It wasn't so long ago that Mark said to me inventing Bergson was for him a piece of juvenilia. So if that's where he started, I'm frightened to say where he's gone to. But he's written major works on cubism and most recently, in fact, on the avant-garde fascism produced in 2007. And I think, Mark and Vivian, you're going to talk to us a bit about putting together the present exhibition. Mm.
Sure. Well, if we're going to talk about Genesis, it actually started with a phone call mm-hmm. and discussing we sort of come from two slightly different backgrounds. As Tom said, I'm an Italianist, and Mark had done a great deal of work on the French.
Yes, continental modernism. Thank you very much for those kind words about inventing Bergson. But also, although I'm living in the United States, I'm Canadian, and as you know, Lewis hated Canada and Canada loves Lewis. So I was exposed to Lewis's work by going up to Ottawa to the War Museum, where there are these incredible mural-sized works by the vorticists executed during the war. And used to make pilgrimages to the Ontario Gallery of Art, where there's a tremendous collection of Henry Moore's work. So British modernism was always on my mind, and when I went to Yale, I had the wonderful opportunity of curating a small exhibition of Gaudier-Bresca drawings, and going against the tide of the very French orientation there with Robert L. Herbert, who was my advisor, developed that interest, and then subsequently, having done a number of different works on continental modernism, I decided I really wanted to turn back and take another look at this, because in Inventing Bergson, I had a chapter on the rhythm circle and was very interested in Gaudier then, among other artists, but even more so, having written a book on Bergson, then worked on Georges Seurat, which culminated in a book on his impact on fascism in France. I kept in the back of my mind rehearsing the fact that these intellectual figures were fundamental, I think, as Paul Edwards quite rightly says, to the development of British modernism. And there are a number of very excellent scholars who've gone on to work in this area as well. I was very inspired by the kind of quality of art history coming out of Britain at the time. So decided to turn to that, and much to my delight, Vivian and I had a phone conversation, and I knew of Vivian's work because she has done tremendous fundamental work on Italian divisionism and is now working on futurism. So maybe I should let you carry on the conversation.
But so to sort of sum up the genesis, I had done work on early futurism and particularly on Boccioni, whom Mark has also worked on, in fact. And of course, when one works in a major museum, often we're told, come up with ideas for shows. What's the ism that hasn't been done, you know? And going through the futurist research, I kept on coming tripping over vorticism, but not really having, besides the Sprengel show, not really knowing of an exhibition that had been done outside of the UK on the movement. And certainly not in the United States, and not in Italy, because the scale of the work we knew early on would be appropriate for the Peggy Guggenheim, where also could be seen the context of Peggy's collection of Cubism and the Mazzioli collection of Futurism. So it was a great kind of three-way view of what was happening right in that moment of the teens. And I think we immediately realized that we had to compete with some major productions that had preceded us and fill some very big shoes. And just looking at our feet. And so we wanted, and we also wanted it to be something very focused that just addressed the movement in its time. And not necessarily make qualitative judgments about it, I might add, one way or the other, but look at it for its moment and what it meant historically. And I think we both thought, oh, let's recreate the Doré show.
Mm-hmm. But then we looked at the Doré show, and we looked at what Richard had to say about the loss of work and realized in a very humbling moment that that would not be enough, given the loss of material, which was so profound. And we're still hoping things will come out of the attic. And sometimes they do, but, you know, it's a daunting prospect. But Vivian, we're both very interdisciplinary in our focus, and Vivian, in fact, has background in literary studies and comp lit and this sort of thing. And so we were thinking more broadly about vorticism from the start, and we were very aware of Pound's impact, John Quinn being a major figure within New York circles. And we thought, well, you know, we should really think of addressing that and address the international context of vorticism. We're very aware of it from an intellectual standpoint, but let's think about it in terms of exhibiting this stuff. And so that led us to broaden the configuration to include the Penguin Club show in 1917 in New York, which Quinn and Pound largely orchestrated. And finally, we thought that we should fold in quite properly and rightly the work of Alvin Landon Coburn. You line this up, and you realize that, in fact, American art and culture had a huge role to play in the sort of public presentation of vorticism.
Sorry, we're moving forward. Sure. But we have a lovely photograph of our Americans here. Mm-hmm. And here as well. So, but and then in it, I guess this is done taken slightly later, but in addition to wanting to underscore these international currents, returning to the idea of how to focus the exhibition, we thought we'll stay in the time frame of its existence, look at these three shows, and try to recreate, find the works we could from the Doré show, the Penguin, and the Vortigraph part of the Camera Club show, and then take on Blast, not only as a journal and for its importance, of course, for the graphics and design and the literature, but as little galleries in and of themselves and see how much of the work we could locate that had been reproduced in the issues of Blast. And this is what gave the exhibition its structure, which you will see upstairs. Although here it's been expanded a bit. We'll be showing some images from Venice, where it was a much tinier conception in a way. And then our American emphasis, as it were, with John Quinn, the collector whose name has come up several times underwriting the Penguin Club exhibition, which Pound curates. But we realized that we couldn't just launch into these three historical exhibitions and do this kind of archaeological project in the United States at the National Museum of Art at Duke or at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice, where nobody even knew who the Vorticists were. They know Vezra Pound, but that was probably it. And so we realized we had to have an introductory room to kind of present, here are the players in this history. So,
So we did decide to bring back or bring together works that are seen as seminal within the development of vorticism, but preceded it slightly, but set the tone and stage for the movement. And here, for instance, you have a symbolic, as it were, collaboration between Gaudier Bresca and Ezra Pound in the Hieratic Head, which we're very pleased to be bringing back to London since it left, I think, Richard, in the 1920s, was it?
It came here briefly in the 1980s, and the Tate Gallery very nearly acquired it. I remember Alan Burness, who was then the director, being very excited. But for all sorts of quite complicated reasons, the purchase never happened.
They're usually complicated, aren't they?
And it was only because of Ray Nasher's sudden passing, in fact, because the National Museum of Art in Texas, in Dallas, didn't want to lend the work because it does have a small crack in it, but it's fine. He had actually willed the work to the National Gallery in Washington, and so this was a coup for us, and all of this happened during the organization of the show. Not that we were, you know, happy about anybody's death, but we did get the sculpture. And then other, of course, seminal figures to include were Jacob Epstein, and we were able to have the wonderful rock jewel recreation in Venice as well, albeit slightly cramped. Wyndham Lewis, and we thought it was key to put in, this is really the only surviving vorticist full-size painting, so that to put that in the first room again to really give people the proper kind of introduction. And Bomberg, because of course his involvement early on with the movement was so key as well. And this also brings to mind something, which is that a number of the works were quite large, but when we went to recreate the show, of course what was left for the most part were small works on paper and watercolor and so forth. So it was also, I think, important to have these works up front in our particular situation here. I think an audience is much more familiar with vorticism, to make people understand that there were large-scale works, too. They're just gone now. Though, of course, we are all hoping more will come out of the attic with this exhibition. It's possible.
Right.
And then from then, we... this is just a shot of how you can see the Peggy Guggenheim spaces are much smaller. But we went on to then have rooms that focused on the exhibition, but we also look to ephemera. And if you want to talk a little bit about, there are a number of archives that are in the States, which are useful for us.
Yes, you know, in keeping with the interest in vorticism in North America, that there, and I think this is probably because of again, the literary dimension of things.
Absolutely.
Pound and Lewis being considered major figures among English modernists, that is, people who study English per se. And as a result, American institutions have been eager to collect and acquire things. So, for instance, as you probably know, Ezra Pound's papers are at the Beinecke at Yale University. Cornell has a wonderful Wyndham Lewis collection. And I don't know, Paul, how did that end up at Cornell?
Walter Mischel gave it to them.
Right.
The Beinecke, they've got an inscribed, the only edition of Timon of Athens, a mock-up with the play, and the plates in position, dedicated to John Quinn.
Right. Right.
As well.
So that's fabulous. And Walter Mischel, by the way, lives in Princeton. Omar Pound, of course, was in America, and he bequeathed a lot of material to Hamilton College, from which we drew for the wonderful Dorothy Shakespeare works that are in the exhibition. And also there's an interesting collection of material which is in Buffalo. And you've mentioned the Harry Ransom Center down in Texas, which is a fabulous repository. So some of our ephemera, posters, for instance, such as this poster here, came from, I think it was Cornell, but there's also a copy that actually exists, I think, in Buffalo. I'm pretty sure there is. So, you know, that literary connection meant that we had a lot of material we could draw on, books and other sorts of things, which we've included in the exhibition.
And maybe just to wrap up the archives and works in America discussion, Coburn ended up being rather annoyed with Bath at some point and then gave a large part of his archive to Rochester's, the Eastman House, the photography collection there. Mm-hmm. And so we both went up there and found that there were lots of Wadsworth prints and negatives, mm-hmm. with when one could see paintings in the background. And so that, again, was kind of a moment of aha, archaeology, mm-hmm. coming to life. So with the Doré, we found the works we could that had been exhibited there, and maybe this is the moment to speak to machine aesthetics versus the hand carved.
Right, sure. Well, I think actually, you know, Richard, in the monument that you have produced, I can say no less than that, because it is a tremendous achievement. One of the things that you address, I think, and do so very eloquently, is the fact that vorticism is undergirded by primitivism and machine aesthetics, and those two things are not necessarily separate. They can come together, and I think they do, especially as Gaudier evolves in terms of his own aesthetic interests. So you move from something like the singer to the red stone dancer, but both of them are characterized by this ideology, I'll call it that, of direct carving. In my own work, I've explored the way in which he was involved in anarchist circles and was thinking about the medium as part of the message and the method of creation as part of the message too. Direct carving, direct action, politics of the anarchists being things that for him bore some relationship to each other. So when one looks at the work that he presented in the Doré, it's all direct carving, but it is in a plurality of different styles, which is quite striking, as you'll see when you go through our Doré room. But I do see those things as in a tension relationship to each other, the primitivism, machine aesthetics, but definitely, as Richard's pointed out, coming together in their imagination, as it did for the futurists.
That's true.
And who knows what Gaudier might have gone on to do had he lived, mm-hmm. with his bringing his war experience to
That's
bear
true.
On his work. Wow, can you imagine?
Yeah. Obviously, one of the other surviving vorticist works is Wyndham Lewis's workshop, which Chris Stevens was reminding me was discovered in a junk shop in the Midwest at some point in the 60s, was it? Is that when?
Yeah, I think so.
Thereabouts. Mm-hmm. And salvaged, luckily. So the Tate was, we couldn't have done the show without the Tate, so thank you so much. And in the cases where works were lost, we cheated a bit, as it were, but put in studies that were related to those works. So we knew Two-Step was in the Doré show, so we put in the study, and here you'll also see the drawing for that work alongside it. So that was a way to represent things when we couldn't obviously recuperate these lost paintings.
Just one more comment related to that, and Paul Edwards has written about this. The vorticists did, and Lewis in particular, but I think Roberts and the others, they really did conceive of these studies in some cases as finished works. So in that sense, you know, the work that you're going to see is not preliminary. It can hold its own within the context of a finished work.
Thank you. And yeah, I think that, like you, Paul, you would agree with Lewis, that's particularly true. It's really,
definitely.
Yes.
There, of course, there are six or seven huge oils that...
Well, maybe they'll come up.
Some of which he cut up himself, of course.
Yeah.
Well, maybe somebody out there has got them.
Yes.
So here we have, I mean, this was one of the woodcuts that we saw was at the Eastman House, and Mark also went back to the negatives of Coburn's photographs and realized that when he was doing his Men of Mark series, photographing important men of the moment, and he did several of the vortices, that lost paintings are visible in the backgrounds of these photographs, and here we actually see Rotterdam, and of course, what's come down to us now is the print. Helen Saunders was another sort of discovery for us in that we learned that her work, a lot of these works have been bought by John Quinn out of the Penguin Show. He dies suddenly, so they get dispersed in funny ways. But four of Saunders' works end up at the University of Chicago at the Smart Museum, so we were lucky to get the Island of Laputa as one. And let's see if we can go forward. And here just an installation shot again of how one gallery looked in Venice. Oops, sorry about that. And then we had two sections focusing on Blast. And here we, again, tried to look to works that had been, well, you'll see from the show, I don't have to over-explain this, works that had been reproduced in Blast. Again, we took a tiny bit of liberty in that we wanted to include the great Epstein sculptures. So based on the fact that studies for these had been in Blast, we went ahead and put those in to actually... In Italy, these were the most popular thing in the entire exhibition. People loved them. I kid you not, they were really popular. And again, there was more. Wadsworth becomes, obviously, his because one has more than one print, his woodcuts survived in a way maybe that some other things didn't, so we were able to include these. And here you see another shot of the show at the Guggenheim and the other way. And maybe speak to Blast Ward.
Well, you know, another logic behind this inclusion is, of course, when Wyndham Lewis and his cohorts sought to advertise Blast, they referred to it as a kind of picture gallery. So they had it in their minds as an imaginative way of giving a virtual gallery to the public. And so Vivian and I took that to heart, and we thought we should really try to, you know, bring that dimension of things out in our installation. So, as Vivian's saying, we included a number of works related to Blast 1 and 2. And in this case, we have another example of a lost work, Shakespeare's Snow Scene from Blast Number 2. We went up to the Emerson Gallery in Hamilton and looked at their extraordinary collection of Dorothy Shakespeare, just fabulous work. And it really galvanized us, and so we chose some particular works from that collection which highlight her innovation, the kind of work that was the abstraction, the degree of startling abstraction that she was involved with, and also the extent to which she was working with Pound on designing book covers for some of his early books of poetry, and I think we've got some examples of those as well.
Just another example of a work that we did locate that had been reproduced, obviously, in black and white in the second issue of Blast. And here, again, Nevinson, his sort of brief moment of inclusion in the Vortices group, although he'd already had his disruption with Lewis. But we put in a pastel and an etching, and I think here also there is the original for the actual Blast image. The Tates made some very, very nice additions. And here you see a gallery again in Venice. And this is what Mark was referring to with regard to looking to books that, and the importance of Dorothy Shakespeare in all of this and what was what's up at the Emerson Gallery and her design for the cover of Catholic Anthology, which then also allowed us to highlight, of course, the incredible literary dimension of the group, and this is the first time that T.S. Eliot is published.
Yes, this is where the love song for J. Alfred Prufrock appeared, and then riposte there. I think, who is it signed to, Vivian?
It's a ironic moment. It's to Sophie Gaudia-Brechka from Ezra Pound, and they later on don't get on so well after Gaudia's death, and even before, really. But
And then, of course, we've got the memoir, famous memoir that Pound wrote of Gaudia-Brechka as a third item in this particular display.
And then the final, well, not the final, but the Penguin Club exhibition in New York was a mini Lewis retrospective, in essence. And so because Pound was the curator and he was telling Quinn Lewis was the most important of the vorticists, they had wanted to do an exhibition about Gaudia, but because of the problems with Sophie in particular, it didn't quite work out. They wanted to do a memorial exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Met would have done it, but in any case. And so, interestingly, there are pre-vorticist works in this later section of the exhibition because these were the actual works that had been sent over to the Penguin. And this is where we were the most successful, whereas there were large-scale paintings which had been lost. A lot of the work on paper in the end has survived so that pretty much everything you will see in that gallery was really in New York in 1917 and seen there. That just was rather exciting for us. And went the range. So you go to the other end of, you know, and this is one of Lewis's really great quasi-abstract compositions. So people got the entire range of his work. But all, of course, the other vorticists were also included in smaller ways with people like Etchells. And maybe you want to talk Saunders.
Sure. This was a wonderful discovery that Vivian and I made of Helen Saunders' work. These three works, which were presumed to be lost, but turned up in a collection of Roosevelt University in Chicago and have subsequently been purchased by the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago, which is wonderful because they also own the Isle of Laputa, also by Saunders, a wonderful collage that she did. So these works had been presumed to be lost, and you know, we found them. They had not been exhibited. The university did not have a gallery. They were simply inventoried in storage. And I remember picking them up, looking at them, and seeing that they had this little sales tags from the Quinn sale on them still. And they'd somehow migrated there from a dealer in Chicago, I believe in the 1950s. Unfortunately, I said, oh, great, and, you know, I can see the provenance of this, but we were informed that that dealer's material had all been, you know, lost. So we do not know exactly how these works came to Chicago. But there they are in absolute pristine condition because they've been shown so little.
Well, barely. So, in fact, the color is true because, as we know, with watercolor, it fades so easily. And here we really get a sense of how strong and daring and different their palette really was from anybody else, cubist or futurist.
And this is a particularly interesting moment since Saunders was herself working alongside Lewis, doing mural decorations and things of this sort. So don't want to dwell on it too much.
And just another shot of the installation again that you can see in Venice. And then we also learned in our research, looking at the papers of John Quinn at the New York Public Library, that because it does not show up in the Penguin Club catalog, that in fact Wadsworth had sent over several sets of his woodcut prints, and that those were probably, we guessed, available for people to view in a portfolio format at the Penguin Club. And here you see a ledger from Quinn's accounting books that shows he bought an entire set himself. And then we learned that subsequent to the close of the Penguin Club show, the works he didn't buy, which were very few, there were some by Wadsworth, and here's an example of one of the prints, and some by Dismore, he sent off to the Sunwise Turn bookstore, which was this avant-garde bohemian bookstore where pretty much everyone went. And so I think things got more exposure there, although I haven't been able, neither one of us has been able to locate photographs that, this was the subject of my catalog essay, and I was dying for a photo where you could see them on the walls of the bookstore, but one hasn't come up yet, if you have one. So that was another interesting sort of new piece of the puzzle for us, when it explains why there are Wadsworth prints floating around in the United States, too. And then, again, here you see we did a little cabinet de dessin for the prince preceding the penguin. And the final piece of the puzzle was the vortigraphs.
And it was very interesting, again, in keeping with the Anglo-American connection, Coburn and Pound collaborating in 1916 and thinking about the vortigraphs. And Richard Cork, in his two-volume discussion of these works, quite rightly says they are riveting and amazing, and indeed arguably the first abstract photographs ever made. So Coburn and Pound worked together, I think it's fair to say, Coburn developing a kind of tube through which he put his lens, triangular shaped mirrors, and put this this apparatus with the lens inside of it, and then took photographs, I think on a glass table, of various objects, gem-like shapes, crystalline forms, shards of glass, or I should say mirrors, and other objects. And Tom has talked about these works and their complexity in the exhibition catalog very eloquently. As a way of trying to configure a vortice's sensibility through the lens of Coburn's own pictorialism, but also within the context of what he saw as some of Pound's precepts for what vorticism was about. So they're very, very striking, interesting works of art. And as we found again in our research and through looking at the correspondence, at one point, Coburn wanted to have an exhibition of these works in America. He was going to have an exhibition, I believe, in Boston and in New York. That never came about for very complex reasons. But again, it points to the fact that the vortices had aspirations to address an Anglo-American audience more broadly. And they brought this sensibility to their aesthetic and to their polemical propagandation of the movement. So there was that phenomena going on in the minds of Pound, Coburn, and the others.
And I think with that, you see just a shot of the photographs, and we can wrap up, because otherwise no one will have time for questions.
Thank you very much. That is astonishing. Speaking of someone who's never curated an exhibition, it's incredible just what kind of journey it is. And I think one of the things that you'll see, if you've not already seen the show, is just how alive and exciting and challenging these works remain after a century. Everyone's had a chance to speak, but of course you've not yet had a chance to speak, and we have got a few minutes, and we've also got two microphones. So if anyone has any questions that you'd like to address to the panel, I'm ready to. Yeah, can we have one down here? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow's papers, because there's so much to find out about. But it strikes me already that vorticism is to a greater degree than most art isms a construction of its historiographies, and the conflicts in the historiographies are really striking. I'm sure we'll explore the interface between literary and artistic modernisms and vorticism's positioning in relation to those tomorrow, because there's Rebecca Beasley and other papers on that. But I was wondering about the more recent historiography, even including the kind of the way in which the show has been reviewed in the few things that I've come across so far, Craig Rain, but also Brian Sewell, somebody on the radio talking about on Front Row, the evening arts program, all dissing it, and which was really depressing. Whether that says more about the state of British art journalism than anything else, But I was wondering, both regard to with regard to Richard Cork's experience in the 1970s and why he had to excavate this material, although, as you say, Dofay had already begun to, and William Weiss in Canada had already done some of that. But and with regard to the present, is there something going on here? I mean, it's like the way we in this country deal with the Bloomsburys. There are such historical animosities. Are there animosities that you would, especially the three British representatives of the panel, with the greatest respect to Mark and Vivian, whether the Brits could say anything more about these subterranean, these under-the-surface currents of animosity towards Vorticism and its history?
Richard, since you were you were named here.
Well, I haven't read the reviews that you're talking about, so I have a problem there. I mean, I don't know. It's sort of baffling. I mean, I grew up at a time when the Brits hated modernism. I remember so clearly in the 1950s and even in the early 1960s, everybody who was adult sort of dissed modern art. I mean, it was a sort of British thing. And it was really only kind of during the 1960s that whole attitude began to change. I mean, I was so lucky growing up as a teenager during that decade, because looking back now, I mean, I realise what a total revolution happened then and how we rediscovered all these isms that had been rubbished. And one of the great revelations I remember was here at the Tate, good old Tate, 1966, an exhibition organised by an artist, Richard Hamilton, called The Almost Complete Works of Marcel Duchamp. Unbelievably, this was the first, I mean, it's extraordinary, this was the first retrospective of Duchamp to be held in Europe. Just think about that. And think about the impact it had upon people of my generation. So I'm surprised that you're saying that. I mean, we're not going back, are we, to the 1950s now?
No. I mean, I think actually what we do tend to forget is the partial understanding, the partial degree to which modern art history had been constructed at that point.
Sorry, I think we underestimate that. I mean, look at Camilla Gray's discovery of Russian art. Look at everything that happened in the 60s about Russian art.
Yeah.
And obviously the kind of Greenbergian modernism had pushed all of that understanding aside. So there was a kind of dominant discourse that was really being unpicked at that point. And I remember one of the greatest shows I ever saw at the Hayward was the Art in Revolution show of 1970,
yeah,
which did similar things. So we tend to project back from a present where we're so archival and kind of meticulous, if you like, about all of this. We tend to project back our wonder at why wasn't this known about. But it was much more piecemeal then than now. But there still seems to be, I don't know, maybe it's just the reviews I've read, there's a kind of animosity towards...
Well, actually, although you asked the British representatives on the panel, I heard groans from the two curators who seem... Have you read the reviews and are you aware of an animosity towards...
The mixed, and I'm actually very glad you said what you did, because when the exhibition was in Italy, it was wildly popular. We had 117,000 visitors, which for the Peggy Guggenheim is quite a large number. And I was a little concerned that there would be the, oh, this is just bad futurism, because as much as futurism is left out of the canon that only does a Paris-centric world with cubism, so vorticism is then left out of the canon, except for people like Chanchi or the Pontius Holton show, but generally speaking, when looking at futurism generally. And instead, I think that having something that looked slightly familiar made people excited, and they were thrilled to discover that in Britain there were all these connections with Marinetti. I mean, the self-referentiality probably helped. Every major newspaper reviewed the show positively, and every little sort of regional journal did as well. And we just got reviewed in Art Forum, and they can be rather difficult sometimes. And the exhibition was very positive. I mean, it was discussed very intelligently. And so I was asking, actually Paul and Richard earlier, why is there this sort of sense of embarrassment almost on the part of the British about, oh yes, we weren't as good as the Cubists? Is that it?
I do feel there's that kind of snobbery. Sorry, I also feel that the kind of modernist art history is way ahead in this country and elsewhere of all of this. And I do think it does say something about the state of British art journalism that, you know, they are so ignorant about contemporary thinking about this. You know, there's this residual snobbery that seems to permeate it.
One of the things, I listened to those radio programs on the iPlayer yesterday, and one of the things that came across to me was that the people who were reviewing it was as if they'd never heard of this movement, and they weren't even really sure if it existed, and they got their facts wrong and talked about Kate Latchmere, for example, Latchmere instead of Kate Latchmere. It's that residual snobbery that nothing before Brit art of importance is produced in this country. And of course, as well as that, there's a certain amount of political suspicion, because they know, quote, that these people are all bad hats, or they will turn into bad hats later on.
Any other questions?
I just wanted to take David up for mentioning name in this room. I don't. I mean, I think that's and it is about the quality of British art criticism in this country. If you get a bad review from Brian Sewell, that's a compliment. But seriously, yes, he's vicious and hates Tate. And I do actually think that Richard, if I may be a flatterer for a moment, is one of the few informed critics writing in the paper at the moment about historical shows. Adrian Thrall, of course, is very good in The Guardian. But the state of British art criticism is very, very poor. We know that. And therefore, there's no comment to make. At least that's what I would say. So it's rather sad, but...
I've just been around the exhibition beforehand and I really enjoyed it. I'm an artist as well. I looked a lot at university, a lot of these artists as well. And one of the things I always ask myself, it's a very simplistic question really, is I feel kind of it's not as good as everyone else's, but the size of, the sizes I noticed that I actually did expect to see bigger and more of a section of larger pieces. But I guess if there isn't, there isn't. But what do you... I mean, do you judge a large piece of work? How do you judge that against a smaller piece? Does that make it more important? I mean, how do you see that, just generally speaking, in exhibitions as a whole?
Depends on what curator you are, I think.
I think that's to you too, because you're the one.
We can all speak to this, though, because we have all worked with visual art, and... a small work, a miniature from a manuscript can be the most incredible thing and have much greater value than some large mural, from some public building. I don't think size, matters. So.
It's a very interesting question that you raise, because actually, if you take Lewis alone, it's quite clear that he wanted to do big paintings at this period, not only on canvas, but also on walls. He did rooms. He did the Tour Eiffel restaurant with Helen Saunders, which tragically, not a trace, not even a faintest photograph remains.
Have you seen the little leaflet for the exhibition? There's one photograph of diners in the Vortices room at the Tour Eiffel, the Eiffel Tower restaurant, with Red Duet, with small Red Duet behind it.
Red Duet, yeah.
Fascinating.
But Lewis was doing, the, as it were, the Les Demoiselles d'Avignon of British art history was, and we ought to mention it really, was this massive painting called Kermesse, which was first exhibited, if at all, at the Cave of the Golden Calf, which was a nightclub in London, And then it was re-exhibited and altered by Lewis, and it was taken over to America. It was acquired by Quinn. It was sold in the Quinn sale. It was bought by somebody who called Richard Wyndham, who also owned other equally large paintings by Wyndham Lewis. And boy, where have they gone? When I was researching my book, I contacted Freddie Mayer, who was for many years a leading London dealer, because I knew that he knew Richard Wyndham. And he said to me, he's a very nice guy, Freddie, he said, I'm terribly sorry, Richard, but I have a horrible belief that Richard Wyndham destroyed those paintings. I said, what? Why? And he said, well, Lewis fell out with him. And as we all know, Lewis was the enemy. Apparently they had a terrible falling out. And Richard Wyndham, according to Freddie Mayer, I mean, you know, we don't know, do we? So maybe somewhere in a junk shop, could be in America, could be over here, you might find something lurking in a corner, covered in dust, okay? Rolled up, even. Just take a bit of time, unroll it, and you might make the discovery of a lifetime. Just go for it.
I'm under instructions to finish by 6:30, so I'm really very sorry that we can't take any more questions. I would say that this event here is a prelude to tomorrow's event, and tomorrow there will be a conference, symposium, with a vast array of what are fascinating papers. I hope to see you all there tomorrow. But meanwhile, I wonder if, on your behalf, I can thank our panelists for their extraordinary presentations. Thank you.